All right, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor.
All right, are there any preliminary matters?
No, Your Honor.
2 days in a row. I like that. That's a good idea. Great. All right, Mr. Depp, you can take your place on the stand, please. All right, you're ready for the jury?
Yes.
Okay. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. All right, you can have a seat. And sir, just a reminder that you're still under oath, Mr. Depp, okay? All right.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right.
Good morning, Mr. Depp.
Good morning.
Yesterday, you told us a little bit about the beginning of your relationship with Ms. Hurd. When did Ms. Hurd's behavior towards you begin to change?
I believe, as I said yesterday, there was a hint of something with the having to do with the boots coming off and breaking routine. Her attitude, or her the way that she would begin to speak to me, things started coming up, and it was, I was suddenly just wrong about everything. I made a statement about something that I had been familiar with, for example, in my work that I'd been chopping away at for a good 30-some years. I was suddenly wrong. And then beyond that, if you tried to explain yourself and correct the problem, the misunderstanding, it would then begin to heighten as Ms. Hurd was unable to be wrong. It just didn't happen. She couldn't be wrong. So these little digs it would commence with sort of demeaning, name-calling, berated, sort of to be made a fool of. And those would escalate into a full-scale argument. And in the beginning, as one does, one sticks up for oneself in a debate, as it were, or an argument over something to try to prove the point. But when it escalates, and then it's hard to explain, but the argument would start here, and then it would roll around and become this circular thing of its own. So you get back to the beginning, essentially, of the argument. Now it's heightened even more, but it's still circular, and there's no way in or out. If there's a dialogue between two people, both people need to speak, but there was no way to fit a word in. It was a sort of a rapid fire, sort of endless parade of insults and looking at me like I was a fool, and I just couldn't. I was having difficulty in my mind, of course, and in my heart, dealing with that sort of barrage. And part of that is I was confused as to the fact that whatever her age was at the time of these various arguments, she was mid-20s to late-20s and into 30s. I couldn't understand how I had somehow arrived at where I'd arrived from where I came from in the beginning of my life, and worked for 30 plus years doing these things. It was astounding how wrong I was about everything that I'd experienced within the movie and within the film industry, or in just life itself. I was sort of not allowed to be right, not allowed to have a voice. So at a certain point, when what enters your mind is, you start to slowly realize that you are in a relationship with your mother, in a sense. And I know that that sounds perverse and obtuse, but the fact is that some people search for weaknesses in people, that is to say, sensitivities. And when you've told that person your life and what you've lived through and what you've been through, just as happens in relationships, the more that became ammunition for Ms. Hurd to either verbally decimate me or to send me into a kind of tailspin of confusion and depression it's not a happy day, it's not a happy week, it's not a happy month when you're constantly being told how wrong you are about this or that, what an idiot you are, or anything. It increased, and it became an endless endless circle. Like, so as it escalated and continued to escalate, I went straight to what I had learned as a youth, which was to remove myself from the situation so that it couldn't continue, because there's only so much your ears can hear and never forget. So I would remove myself from the situation, as I'd done as a youth, as much as possible. Because I certainly didn't believe that there was any need for these various subjects or arguments to come up and travel the distance that they did so very quickly, to ramp up so fast. It was like you were pinned to a wall and had to just listen to it and take it. So I found the only way to find any sort of peace was to try to walk away. If she didn't allow me to walk away, there were times when I would just go and lock myself in, the bathroom or anywhere that she couldn't get into. And that happened constantly over the years.
What would happen when the fights would escalate, other than going and hiding in the bathroom?
I'm sorry? What would happen? Well, if they continued to escalate, if I continued to try to present my version or my side of the story, when you're approached when you're approached with such anger and hatred, it seemed like pure hatred for me. If I stayed to argue that, eventually I was sure that it was going to escalate into violence, and oftentimes it did. Many times it did.
And when you say violence, what are you referring to specifically?
Ms. Heard, in her frustration and in her rage and her anger, she would strike out. She would. It could begin with a slap. It could begin with a shove. It could begin with, throwing a TV remote at my head. It could be throwing a glass of wine in my face. But it was a built-in list of as I said, my personal experiences, which I gave to Ms. Heard, those things were. Those facts were used against me as weapons, especially when it came to my kids. There was no need for it. There was no need for it. Too many lines were crossed. You couldn't see the lines anymore.
You mentioned that Ms. Heard would use information you gave her against you like a weapon. Can you explain that a little bit?
I've said this before in various interviews, but certainly in life. If I have one ambition, and ambition for me, when you equate it with Hollywood, has become an ugly word in a sense, because ambition means I want to be famous at any cost. I don't care what for, I just want to be famous. That's one thing, that's one part of it. If you have hunger or a need or a drive to present your work. That to me is the way to go about it. Fame has nothing to do with it. So I was more, I mean, basically, the only ambition that I've ever had in my life arrived the second that my first child arrived, and in the second, in the instant, which was to be a good parent, to be a great father, to be the best father I could. And there were several occasions where Miss Heard would tell me what a bad father I was, and that I had no idea how to parent. And again, it falls into the same category as before. I couldn't understand how in 52 years or however old I was at the time, how I could be so wrong about everything. I mean, one learns along the road. The result of the road is not important. It's the road that's important, because we don't know exactly what's going to happen in 10 years. We don't know. So the road is what I pay attention to, and paying attention to trying to spend as much time with my children as possible. That could send Miss Heard into a monumental tailspin, where I could hardly ever go and see my kids and spend time with my kids, because she had to have me there at all times for her own needs.
So,
and that was something that, once you realize that that's happening, and then there are hassles between the children and her, the situation starts to get a little more grim and a little more dire. And that I was not prepared to take. I would not hear the words, "You're a bad father, you're a terrible father, you're an awful father." So one can only take so much of that before bits of your heart begin to, the valve gets shut off, because you can't hear it anymore. And you know that it's not true, and you know that it's meant as a whip. It's to slice you up. It's to bring you down. It's to demean you. It's to bring you into a place where you start to believe that there's something wrong with you. And there's plenty wrong with me. There's plenty wrong with a lot of people. But in all of these situations, my main goal was to retreat, because I think in life, most important is pick your battles. If there's a battle to be fought that it's grave and important, then that must be dealt with. But small insults and kind of teenage sort of high school tactics, this bullying, if you will, was becoming too much to take.
So why did you stay with Miss Heard given this type of behavior?
That's a very complicated answer. I would I can only say that I stayed through all that. I'm sure that it's somehow related to my father remaining stoic as my mother would beat him to death. I'm sure it'll had a lot to do with having been in a beautiful, wonderful 14, 15 year relationship with Vanessa, the mother of my children. Raising those kids was, there was, I had no interest in being a, you know, the words that they use that I dislike very much, a celebrity or an entertainer. Or fame is a strange word because I could never equate it with myself. I pumped gas, I worked construction, I printed t-shirts, I dug in, you know, I had many, many jobs before any of this happened to me. So I've been able to live both sides of that life, of life. I know the very lows, and I know the very highs of where my life has gone. And it would be pure idiocy for me to sit up here as an actor who's been very, very fortunate over the years. And I can only say it's luck, in a sense that someone hands you the ball in the beginning and you run with it and you run as far as you can before you get tackled. So that's what I've always done. But what happens is when the word celebrity public figure, that's what it is, a celebrity or a public figure, again, not complaining, but there are things that are very uncomfortable, and that is to say that at that point anybody can say anything they want to about you. And that's happened to me over 36 years or more, that things can be printed in the newspaper that are utterly false. This is even early on. So this is where that privilege, I suppose, that they call the privilege of celebrity, that's where that sticks a knife in you. Because it's one of those, that's one of those situations where your arms are too short to box with God, you know. There are too many of them coming at you. I don't know what her motivations were, if there was some species of jealousy or there was some species of maybe just hatred, I don't know. But in any case, the elevation and the escalation of these day-to-day arguments were simply unnecessary. It was not to help the relationship. It did not help the relationship. It wasn't meant to help the relationship. It was meant to feed her need for conflict. She has a need for conflict. She has a need for violence. It erupts out of nowhere, and what I learned, the only thing I learned to do with it is exactly what I did as a child. Retreat. Just take a step back, which I told her, we need to remove ourselves from each other, even for an hour, a day, anything. Because this can't go on. No one can live like this, you know. But why did I stay? I stayed, I suppose, because my father stayed. I suppose because I had been in that relationship with Vanessa, and that was lost, and I didn't want to fail. I wanted to try to make it work. I thought maybe I could help her. I thought maybe I could bring her around, because the Amber Heard that I knew for the first year and a half was not this opponent. It wasn't my girl. It was she had become my opponent, and everything that I did just didn't fit her. She didn't accept it. So I stayed because, of course, I didn't want to fail. I didn't want to hurt anyone, especially Miss Heard. I didn't want to break her heart. I remember very well that when my father left and my mother, Betty Sue, had that first attempt at suicide that I woke up to, and that visual in my head, and that was a direct result of my father's leaving. Ms. Heard had spoken of suicide on a couple of occasions, so that also becomes a factor. That's also something that always lives in the back of your brain, and that you fear. Because when I would leave sometimes, many times when I would try to leave, she would, stop me at the elevator with the security guards crying, screaming, you know, I can't live without you, I'm gonna die. But you had to get out. There were even a couple of times when I did escape and I got to my house, arrived at my house in Sweetser, and then 5 minutes later she would arrive in the I don't know what car she was driving at the time, but she would arrive in her nightgown screaming in the parking lot in front of my house, screaming to high heavens, and it'd be 4 in the morning, 3 in the morning. It was ludicrous. It was out of control. It was uncontrollable.
Did there come a time when you and Ms. Heard started recording your arguments?
Yes. I was the first person of the two of us to record conversations. And it was for this reason. We would have been talking the night before or arguing the night before, and she would say something. There would be these demeaning, berating insults. There would be these jabs. There would be anything to make me feel small and like nothing. So what I thought was, I'm going to record the conversation. And I told her this. I'm going to record. I'm going to get my phone and I'm going to record our conversation, because I want you to hear what you've said to me tomorrow. So that you, because she would deny having said those things. What are you talking about? You know, it was It was surreal. She had completely denied things she'd said directly to my face in a heated and volatile way. And she denied it, so I went to her and I said, I'm going to record us. And I did, and we recorded the conversation, which when she was on tape, the first time, it escalated a bit, but she was, well, it was clear that she was performing for the tape because it was being recorded. So that was another clue that something was slightly rotten in the state of Denmark, as it were.
What did Ms. Hurd say to you about you recording the conversations between you and her?
I mean, initially she said, sure, go ahead.
Did that ever change?
No, then she started recording, but surreptitious, without telling me that she was recording something, which is fine, but not so fine, if you know what I mean. Even in those tapes, it never took me to a place where I would go switch into some other entity, which is, as she has used the term, monster. Never switched to violence. Violence was unnecessary. Why would you hit someone to make them agree with you? I don't think it works.
Mr. Depp, you mentioned the term monster, and I think we heard about that in the opening statements. What does the term monster mean to you?
Well, the term monster means to me, you know, in the beginning, she had used a different word to explain the same thing, and she would use the word demons, that my demons were coming out, or that she had noticed that there was a great change in my attitude or my aggressive nature. Or she would say that the demons had come out and they had control of me and that sort of thing. I don't remember exactly how monster came out, but that word stuck and it stayed, well, until this day. What I believe the monster was in Ms. Hurd's mind was her
his belief about what monster meant in Ms. Hurd's mind is not relevant. There's no foundation.
Let me ask a different question.
All right, I'll sustain the objection. Go ahead.
When you used the term monster, what were you referring to in your conversations with Ms. Hurd?
When I used the term monster with Ms. Hurd, I was placating. If she had referred to me as being a monster, there was no way that I was going to sit there and go through a 45-minute argument about, you know, you're a monster. No, I'm not. You're a monster. No, I'm not. You're a monster. No, I'm not. It was an impossibility. So what do? You accept her vernacular. You accept what the word that she uses And then you used that word to placate her so that it would at least calm part of the aggression. It would lessen the attacks, you know. So explaining the monster was for me she had told me many times that the monster was only me when I was using drugs and alcohol. But it, even when I was stone cold sober off of alcohol substances aside from my meds, the term the monster was still there. When she accused me of being high on cocaine or drinking like a, you know, some sort of like I was a, you know, some kind of 19th century sailor, it's that was the word she clung to describe. But it was in her mind, not mine.
How did your relationship with Ms. Hurd affect your substance use?
Well, for example, when we were on the road, you know, when you're traveling from, if you're on a press tour, or if you're making a film and you're staying in hotels or this or that, I would always have to get a different, or we would always have to book an extra room that I was able to escape to, so I didn't have to lock myself in another bathroom. It breaks you down. It the constant haranguing breaks you down. And, you know, there's a part of you that says, listen, if I'm going to be accused of this, might as well just do it. But it never exceeded, my substance abuse or use, the alcohol that I used or drank was, again, purely, it's that little boy who didn't want to hear or didn't want to feel the pain of his mother turning him into some kind of ball of insecurity and pain. So, yes, I was more inspired by Ms. Hurd to reach out for a numbing agent because of the constant clashes, because of the, maybe a few days here and there, but there wasn't a day that you'd wake up and you'd expect something was going to hit the fan, and it, pretty much like clockwork, it did. So, yes, I had to have something to distance me and distance my heart from those verbal attacks. I had to have something to be able to maintain me, and I'm afraid for a while because of placation, because I didn't want to rock the boat, as it were. Again, you pick your battles. So placation seemed the best route if I was unable to escape her clutches.
How, if at all, did Ms. Hurd try to support you in abstaining from the drugs and alcohol as she requested?
Well, I mean, verbally, and she had been quite clear verbally as pretty bullish and brutish about wanting me to, telling me that I needed to stop drinking. But drinking was, basically drinking wine with her, and I for some, I suppose maybe from youth, I don't know, but I've always had a pretty high tolerance for alcohol, for, and especially it's not spirits, you know. I had a pretty good tolerance for alcohol substances and things of that nature, but there was no, I had no, I've worked with therapists, drug counselors, who have actually said the words to me, because I wanted to know. I wanted to know, am I an alcoholic? Am I an alcoholic? Or is this just the same thing that I did as a kid when I took my mom's nerve pill? Do I have a drinking problem? And it essentially came down to this. Do you have a drinking problem, Johnny?
Objection, calls for hearsay. What the doctors told him.
I'm not sure he's saying what the doctors told him.
I think that's what's about to be testified to.
If you can make that clear, I guess.
Let me ask you a different question, Mr. Depp.
Yes, let's let him object to another one.
How often would Ms. Hurd drink in your presence? While you were in a relationship?
Always. Well, yeah. Ms. Hurd drank, she took a shine to a very nice Spanish wine called Vega Sicilia. She and all her friends did. Yeah, the wine would come out and Ms. Hurd could very easily drink two bottles of wine per night. Not a problem. What I found strange was when I did get sober from the I was off the opiates that I had been addicted to prior to a couple of years before. She asked me if I would stop drinking to save the relationship, of course. I stopped drinking. And I always found it odd that in support of me not drinking, that she might stop drinking. But she did not. She continued. And I didn't make a big deal about it. In fact, I would open her wine, I would pour her a glass, and that went on for many, many months, you know, in my sobriety. Like I said, I think I was sober for around 18 months. Then there was a time when I was asked to, and I'd been off of alcohol, I'd been off of drugs, everything, except for the medication that I'm prescribed. I had to go to London to give a Lifetime Achievement Award to a dear old friend who was an elderly man, great actor called, his name's Christopher Lee. And he was a dear friend. And I was surprised, he was being surprised by my showing up on stage. I'd just flown in from the States, and he was surprised by me arriving to give him this award. And Christopher came up and accepted the award. And we walked, they brought us backstage to a this beautiful library where we, I was with Christopher and his wife, and a waiter came up and had three glasses of champagne. And Christopher handed one to his wife, he handed one to me, and then he had the other. And there was a photographer there. And the glass came up to toast. And I just, in my head, I thought, it's just champagne, you know, a little bit tink to toast Christopher and his Lifetime Achievement Award. And so I'd had half a glass of champagne with Christopher Lee and his wife. After that, immediately after that award ceremony, I went to pick up Miss Hurd and take her to dinner at a restaurant. And I told her that I'd had a half a glass of champagne with Christopher. And I thought, listen, it's not like, you know, you're sitting in a pub guzzling pints of snake bites or Guinness or doing shots of Jägermeister, or it wasn't even, at that point, it wasn't even for need to bury feelings or emotions. It was literally a joyous occasion for Christopher. And I said to her, I enjoyed it, you know. It gave me the opportunity to enjoy the actual champagne, the drink, and my appreciation for wine and winemaking, and that I've been fascinated with for years and years. And I saw nothing wrong in it. And I said, I'd like to have a glass of champagne. As she was sitting there with a glass of wine, and we were in the restaurant, and she absolutely lost it and got up and stormed to the ladies' room. And I told my security and driver, I said, I think we have to go. I think we're going to have to leave. So we left the restaurant and went home. And the mere suggestion of me sipping a glass of champagne or having one glass or two glasses of wine, she went apoplectic. I was weak. I was a complete mess. I was an alcoholic. I was gonna ruin everything. Your kids are not proud of you. They can't stand what you're doing to yourself. So at that point, I said to her, "Okay, listen. How about this? You want to support me not drinking? I've never asked you this before. How about you stop drinking? How about you get sobriety and share this sobriety with me to support me and help me through this?
What did she say to that?
No. No. She said no. She said she didn't have a problem. But I have never had a physical addiction to alcohol. I don't.
How often have you seen Ms. Hurd use other illicit drugs in your presence?
Several times.
And what drugs were those?
She was always quite fond of MDMA, which is ecstasy. And mushrooms. And she had some medications that she was on already that were, one in particular was quite a high velocity speed, if you will, called, I don't know if I can say the name. Am I allowed to say the name? It doesn't matter.
That's not necessary. How often did you see Ms. Hurd take MDMA?
Well, a dozen times, 20 times, over the course of the years, during the course of the years.
And what about mushrooms?
Mushrooms a little less. Mushrooms probably 6-7 times.
Mr. Depp, do you recall at the beginning of her opening, Ms. Hurd's counsel mentioned that the first time you supposedly struck Ms. Hurd was in response to a comment about one of your tattoos?
Yes, I remember.
And what is your response to that?
It didn't happen. I've never struck Ms. Hurd. As I said yesterday, I've never struck Ms. Hurd. I've never struck a woman in my life. I'm certainly not going to strike a woman if she decides to make fun of a tattoo that I have on my body. That's like going in into someone's journal and picking out things you don't like. She had made mention. There was no incident of argument when the tattoo thing had been brought up many, many times. And I mean, there's really nothing I can do. I've always thought of my body as a journal, if you will, to mark experiences, to mark life experiences. For example, when my first child was born, I had her name tattooed over my heart, which is where her little head used to be when I rock her to sleep. I marked my boy's birth by tattooing myself for him. So no one can go back, or no one should go back and rewrite their journals. Why would I take such great offense to someone making fun of a tattoo on my body? That allegation never made any sense to me whatsoever.
Are there any tattoos that you had that Ms. Hurd had an issue with, to your understanding?
A tattoo that I believe is up here, which used to say, Winona Forever, who was a former girlfriend. And we'd been together for a few years, Winona Ryder, and when we broke up, how do you fix that? I did go back and rewrite my journal to some degree. I took off the last two letters and had it say Wino Forever. Just because I thought it was, again, through pain comes humor. Humor has to come in there at some point into the pain. And that's how you play it out in your mind. So I think sometimes abstractly in that sense, so I changed it to Wino Forever. Any other tattoos? Well, she was very encouraging in me getting a tattoo of her name or whatever, and I waited a while, and then I did it. I got a full tattoo of her, and it ironically wasn't long after that that everything started going sideways. I was doing anything I could to bring a smile to her face as opposed to the frown and then the onslaught of whatever whatever problems she was seeing or experiencing. I would try to wake her up with laughter, you know, singing stupid songs in her ear while she, you know, I generally just tried to keep bringing her mood up. Sometimes it worked, many times it didn't. But I tried, and I wanted to try, because as I said, I didn't want to fail. And at the time, not knowing fully, not understanding fully what I was, if you'll excuse the term, up against, I kept trying. I kept trying, but to no avail whatsoever. Okay, it just got worse.
Mr. Depp, I'd like to fast forward a little bit to May of 2014. Could you please tell the jury what project you were working on in May of 2014?
May of 2014? May of 2014, there were a number of films that I made in succession. I can't remember if that might have been Pirates. No, I can't. Mordecai or May of, I don't remember. Can you remind me what May of 2014 film was?
Were you filming Black Mass in Boston of May of 2014?
Ah, yes, okay, yes. Yes, excuse me. Yes. Yes, yes. Oh, yes. I was filming a film called Black Mass in Boston. And Ms. Hurd had come with me. And I had to, for the film, I had to, there were very early calls to work because I was I had a number of prosthetics glued to my face and blue contacts so that I could resemble the actual, it's based on the true story of James Bulger, James Whitey Bulger. And so I had to go in quite early to get the prosthetics glued to my face and all that, and work, then you'd work, you know, the whole day, and then at the end of the night, they would remove the prosthetics, which takes, if it took 3 hours to put them on, it took about an hour to take them off, you know. So on top of a, what could be a, anywhere between a 14, 16, 17 hour day of work, you know, what with the application of the makeup and then the taking off of the applications.
Was Ms. Hurd staying with you in Boston during the entire time that you were making that film?
Yes. Yes, she was.
And who from your staff was in Boston with you during that time?
Jerry Judge. Keenan Wyatt, Stephen Duders. Nathan Holmes, I believe. And I believe Malcolm Connolly was there as well. So I would have assistants, sound technician, security. I believe that was it.
Mr. Depp, we heard yesterday from Mr. Wyatt about a flight that you and Mr. Wyatt and Ms. Hurd were on from Boston to LA in May 2014. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And could you please tell the jury what you remember about that specific flight?
I remember that as I was still shooting, filming Black Mass, before I did Black Mass, the film, my sister Christy and I were talking about the oxycodones that I had been, again, you know, that was the monkey on my back, that she came to me, she told me she'd read this book of Dr. Kipper's book, and I read Dr. Kipper's book, a good majority of it, and I agreed that I would do the detox. I would kick the opiates, but there was no time to do it before the film. When the nurse, which was Nurse Debbie Lloyd, when she came to Boston, she had asked me, what is your dosage? How many of these are you taking per day? And, you know, someone who had been under, you know, under the kind of lock and key of a prescription drug that is highly addictive. I mean, with built-in barbs, that this drug does not want you to stop taking it. She asked me how many I took per day, or my dosage, and of course, as any person who is addicted and essentially a fool to the drug, and you know how important it is because you have felt the sting when it doesn't, when you don't have it. So I'd agreed to the detox, and she asked me how many I took. I told her, obviously, more than I was taking, purely because when you're in that frame of mind, the one thing that you do not want to, a situation you don't want to find yourself in, is having no access to the thing that will make you, not high, it will make you, it gets you, you only get better from it. If you start to get the shakes and the tremors and the you know, you could feel this traveling into your system. Your receptors are out in mass, and your receptors are demanding that drug. If you don't give the drug to the receptors, you will start going into a pretty nasty withdrawal, and it could, and has ended in, you know, sort of seizures. You can go into pretty nasty seizures. So I had told Debbie Lloyd more than was necessary, so that I could always have one or two in my pocket on the just in case, so I didn't find myself, you know, on a plane or anywhere without one in my pocket to stop the inevitable body cramps and nausea and stomach cramps and seizure of the bones and the shaking, and also it's quite an emotional ride as well. So yes, before the flight, Amber and her assistant Savannah McMillan wanted to be picked up in New York, and then have the plane fly to Boston to pick me up, to bring us back to Los Angeles. We had spoken the night before. We had argued the night before. She was most definitely looking for a fight, actively searching for a way to instigate a fight with me. And I had taken two of these opiates, these roxycodones, and I can tell you now, some of you may be very well aware of this, opiates are extreme downers. So if you have enough opiates in you, you will essentially go on what's called the nod. You'll just drop into sleep. So I've heard the words blackout used, and there's a grave difference between a blackout from alcohol abuse, because that is a person who has ingested enough alcohol to render them, they can still behave and they can still stand and talk and scream and yell and cry and do whatever they do, and never remember a thing. And generally they're always embarrassed by it. A blackout is a very, very different animal to the opiate taking you into dreamland. So when I arrived on the plane, I was not feeling any pain, and I knew that she was ready for some kind of brawl, and I sat on the plane drawing. I was drawing in my notebook. She would verbally heckle, hassle, accuse, poke, prod physically, you know, poke and prod psychologically, emotionally, it just, and finally, you know, as was my, the one thing I learned, if you're gonna hide someplace from somebody, go straight into the bathroom. So I walked back into the back of the plane. I grabbed a pillow and I went into the bathroom, locked the door, and lay down on the bathroom floor and went to sleep. And that's where I remained for the rest of the flight.
How much, if any, alcohol had you had before you got on the flight?
I honestly don't recall having any alcohol. I mean, maybe there was the sort of glass of champagne when you got on the plane or something like that, the initial thing. You know, people order glasses of wine. People also tend to have a few drinks before a plane takes off because some people don't like the turbulence and the this and the that. So it's a little bit of a liquid courage, you know. But I certainly, after ingesting two of the oxycodones, alcohol was not necessary. So I can tell you now that I was not drinking to excess, certainly not. And if I had, I'd probably been in the bathroom hugging porcelain as opposed to sleeping on a pillow.
Who else was on that flight that you can recall?
I remember Jerry Judge was on the flight. Savannah was on the flight. Ms. Hurd. Keenan. Wyatt. Stephen Duders. I believe that's it.
What do you recall happening after you arrived back in LA? Go back to the same home together after that flight?
No, I don't believe, no, we didn't. I don't believe we did. I think she had decided if this is the time. Pretty sure. I believe she had decided to check herself into the Chateau Marmont. If that, there's so many of these. It's hard to sort of keep them all straight.
Who would have paid for Ms. Hurd to stay at the Chateau Marmont?
I would have paid for it. If she wanted to go to the Chateau Marmont, I wasn't going to let her pay for it, no matter the circumstances. I wasn't going to let her pay for it because I knew that that might get expensive for her. So generally I would take care of things of that nature.
And why did Ms. Hurd tell you why she was staying at the Chateau Marmont?
No. Well, I mean, she was clearly upset, and she was irate. I can't say that it was a bad idea for her to stay at the Chateau Marmont at that time. I don't know why she went to the Chateau, since she still had her apartment on Orange, I believe, and the penthouse, because I could have gone to Sweetser, but she went to the Chateau Marmont.
Mr. Depp, do you recall why you were flying from Boston to L.A. in May 2014?
I can't remember if it was a break from the film or if I had finished the film. And that was before we went, before I was supposed to go to the island to detox from the opiates.
I think I'm about to switch gears, is a good time for a break.
All right. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll go ahead and have our morning recess. Please do not do any outside research and don't talk to anybody about the case, and we'll see you in 15 minutes, okay? Thank you. And sir, again, since you're still on the stand, do not discuss your testimony with anybody, including your attorneys, okay? All right, we'll come back at 11:35, all right?
Thank you, Your Honor.